Support for WPR comes from Focus on Energy. Committed to helping Wisconsinites focus on the planet by making smart energy choices. Energy resources for Earth Day and every day can be found at focusonenergy.com.
For the Marines at Khe Sanh and the more than 3 million other men and women who served in Vietnam, music provided release from the uncertainty, isolation, and sometimes stark terror that reached from the front lines to the relatively secure rear areas known as the air-conditioned jungle. But the sounds offered more than simple escape. Music was a lifeline connecting soldiers to their homes, families, and parts of themselves they felt slipping away. It was a glue that bound the communities they formed in their hooches, base camps, and lonely outposts from the Mekong Delta to the ravines of the Demilitarized Zone.
Both in country and back in the world, as the troops called the United States, music helped them make sense of situations in which, as Bob Dylan put it in a song that meant something far more poignant and haunting in Vietnam than it did back in the world, they felt like they were on their own with no direction home. For the fortunate ones who did get back home, music echoed through the secret places where they stored memories and stories they didn't share with their wives, husbands, or children for decades. Music was the key to survival and a path to healing, the center of a human story that's too often been lost in the haze of politics and myth that surrounds Vietnam.
That's Doug Bradley and Craig Werner, co-authors of We Gotta Get Out of This Place, the soundtrack of the Vietnam War. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. Vietnam veteran, teacher, and journalist Doug Bradley, and award-winning UW Afro-American Studies professor and author Craig Werner, collaborated for almost a decade on a project to interview hundreds of Vietnam veterans using their discussions about the music they listened to as a powerful gateway into their experiences in the war. Doug Bradley and Craig Werner join me to talk about We Gotta Get Out of This Place, a widely acclaimed work that Rolling Stone magazine selected as the number one book about music for the year 2015. Welcome back to University of the Air.
Great to be here.
Congratulations, too, on the success of this book. I've known you both for a long time and have seen this book sort of in the works for a long time here. So it's nice to actually have it here and getting the kind of acclaim that it deserves. Can you tell me, before we start sampling some of the music, some of the comments of the veterans, can you tell me why this project and why this co-authored work?
I think why is because the Vietnam vets needed an opportunity like this, needed a forum like this. One of the sad legacies of that war, Emily, is that vets weren't welcome back. They weren't healed. They weren't brought home. They weren't listened to. And, you know, that was because of what surrounded Vietnam. And what we found was that they were really aching to sort of talk to people about their experience and their stories and their pain. And we found that music was the best way to do that. The politics of the war, everything about it has made it difficult. But boy, if you can connect with a song that for them made a difference in their sort of survival, then you had a chance to bring them back.
Do you think the fact that you're a veteran yourself made a difference?
I do. I think it helped. I think, all veterans that survive something like war have survival guilt. And, I had my own from being in the rear in a fairly safe job and pushing a pencil, basically, in an office in Vietnam. And so I've spent the last 40 or 50 years trying to help other vets who didn't have it as good as I did. But it was really when I connected with Craig, who taught my kids here and was, I think, opening up their eyes to the ways music could make community and form bonds, that we finally decided that when we finally got together, that this was a great way to do this. And I think Craig's almost like a vet. I mean, he understands those communities. He's been around a lot of veterans. And I think the fact that I was did help us to get access. But it still, as you know, took a while to get the stories compiled.
And Craig, I know you're known for your works on black music and culture, books like Higher Ground and A Change Is Going to Come. What about this project in particular drew you in?
Well, it's very personal for me. I grew up in a military town, Colorado Springs. I played with a rock and roll band that played for veterans a lot. I spent a year thinking I was going to be drafted. I wasn't. And when I started working with vets here in Madison, it allowed me to go back and uncover part of my own experience that had been buried for a long time, not in the same way it had for vets, but it also was, for both of us, I think, a labor of love. What we did in the book, to the best of our ability, was get ourselves out of the way and let the voices of the men and women who served, Black, white, Chicano, Native American, I think that we capture more of the shared story of Vietnam probably than any other single book that's out there.
One of the things you talk about in an early chapter of the book is how different it was at the beginning of the war, the kind of attitudes that people went in and how that was reflected in the way the music sounded, what would have been called an anthem of Vietnam, changed.
Yeah, we go from Pat Boone, we actually begin the book with Love Letters in the Sand and the Kingston Trio and Tony Bennett, I Left My Heart in San Francisco, to something very, very different by the end of the war. But probably the song that sums up the early war best is The Ballad of the Green Berets by Sergeant Barry Sadler.
Fighting soldiers from the sky, fearless men who jump and die, men who mean just what they say, the brave men of the Green Beret, silver wings upon their chest, these are men America's best. 100 men will test today, but only 3 win the Green Beret. Trained to live off nature's land, trained in combat hand to hand, men who fight by night and day, courage take from the Green Beret. Silver wings upon their chest, these are men, America's best. 100 men will test today, but only 3 win the Green Beret. Back at home, a young wife waits. Her Green Beret has met his fate. He has died for those oppressed, leaving her this last request. Put silver wings on my son's chest, make him one of America's best. He'll be a man they'll test one day. Have him win the Green Beret.
Well, if that doesn't make you want to run through the jungles of Southeast Asia, or at least march, I don't know what does, Emily. What's incredible about that song is that given when it came out, early 1966, 50 years ago, just about this time, it and the Beatles were in their heyday, and the Rolling Stones and Motown was at its best. Music was just, that was the most popular song in the entire year of 1966.
The Green Berets.
The Ballad of the Green Berets. And it was a marketing bonanza because Sadler, being a Green Beret and a soldier, wounded no less, and was at Fort Bragg when he was recovering, and Robert Kennedy was dedicating the Fort Bragg training facility as the Green Beret training facility in honor of his deceased brother. You can't get, there's so much patriotism working into that, that, and then they made it a book and a movie. It was a trifecta. But it was the most parodied song of the Vietnam War era, because you can't get one branch of the military can't get away with saying it's better than any other branch of the military. So other branches of the Army made fun of this song and had their takeoffs on it. Helicopter pilots had, the Air Force had their version, the Marines had their version. And so when it started at this as this call to arms, it became a bit of a joke.
And it generated a certain kind of a kickback. Mm-hmm. We have a solo in the book from Jim Kurtz, who writes about his relationship with the song. And Kurtz writes, "Growing up when I did, it was a reality that if you were a male, you were going to serve in the military. Like a lot of guys in my generation, I grew up on visions of John Wayne movie heroics and World War II victories. I remember believing that there was no chance we were going to lose in Vietnam. By June 1966, I was a wet-behind-the-ears platoon leader with the 101st Airborne at Xi'an. One of the ways I coped was to hum the lyrics to The Ballad of the Green Berets. For me, it was more about the relevance than popularity. It's more than just a song. It's a shared story, an anthem to valor and sacrifice, patriotism and victory. At that time, in 1966, The Ballad of the Green Berets was the Vietnam anthem. But the more I heard the song, the more I compared it to what I was seeing in Vietnam. They didn't square up. It was becoming less heroic. Now, rather than ringing true, the song rings hollow. I thought I wanted to be a hero, and that Vietnam was the place to be heroic, and that's what the song said. It was kind of like On Wisconsin. We're going to march through the country and win the game, save the day. But I don't feel so good about all that now, because of what I saw and what I know. And the Ballad of the Green Berets is a bunch of nonsense, especially the end of the song, where the father dies and asks his wife to put the silver wings on his son's chest. It's nonsense."
And the sound of that song is so different than some of the other songs that you've included in the book, and the kind of music that did become sort of the anthem of the Vietnam War. We hear those trumpets and the marching.
Yes.
And
so different. But, you know, the amazing thing is, Emily, that we all listen to that music. That if you got tired of listening to the Ballad of the Green Berets, because they were going to play that every hour on popular radio, you could hold on, and then they would play something by the Beatles or the Supremes or the Temptations. And that's, I think, what is so unique about what we found with the conversations, and that is that there was such a shared soundtrack, whether you served or you stayed, whether you protested or participated, and everybody brings something to that soundtrack, to that music. Now, if you're in Vietnam and you're going through what Jim Kurtz went through or all the other men and women that we interviewed, then it can take on a different meaning and a different poignancy.
Yeah. And you hear that in the song that really became the Vietnam Vets National Anthem, which was our title song, "We Got to Get Out of This Place," by The Animals.
In this dirty old heart of the city, where the sun refused to shine, people tell me it ain't no use in trying. My little girl, you're so young and fresh, and one thing I know is true, you're gonna die before your time is due. See my daddy in bed dying, see his hair turning gray, he's been working and slaving his life away. I know, as he's been working, yeah, every day, slaving his life away. He's been working, baby, he's been a working, work, work, work. We gotta get out of this place, if it's the last thing we ever do. We gotta get out of this place. And you, yeah. My little girl, you're so young and pretty, and one thing I know is true, you'll
be dead before your time is due. Yes, you will. See my daddy in bed.
Doug, I know you have a piece in the book where you're gathered around and the different soldiers are betting on what song's going to come next on the radio. And it sets up this title song, We Gotta Get Out of This Place. Tell us about that.
Well, it was Labor Day weekend 1971, and here you are in Vietnam. You don't get Labor Day weekend off. There's no three-day weekends in Vietnam. And yet they were doing a countdown of like the 500 best pop songs of all time. So we were getting ready. I mean, this is us. I mean, they're playing our music. So we started to take bets. And, you know, you had people who thought they were going to go with the acid rock and some people who said it had to be Dylan and other people, you know, picking their favorites. And it got to be a pretty substantial wager. We started putting out ration cards, which meant a lot in Vietnam. That's how you bought your beer and your cigarettes and your liquor. And so by the time midnight was approaching, you had the stack of ration cards and guys were taking odds and everybody. And that was the first song they played. We got to get out of this place. And we all sort of looked at each other and said, how did we miss this? I mean, this is our anthem. This is the song we all sing. Why were we thinking about our old selves and what we listened to back home when that is a song that matters in Vietnam? So it was just one of those incredible aha moments. And we could talk all afternoon about that song. But the incredible thing is that it was the anthem. And if you were a cover band there, Filipino, Korean, Vietnamese, even if you're an American band that came in and you didn't play that song, you didn't last long on stage. You had to be able to play that.
And it wasn't originally written as a war song, right?
No, it was originally written by Cynthia Weil and Barry Mann for the Righteous Brothers. And it's just a gorgeous version that they did. It was going to be the follow-up to You've Lost That Lovin' Feeling. It was a Get Out of the Ghetto song. The Animals picked it up and thought it was a song about they're moving from working class grunge in England down to London. They had no idea it was about Vietnam until Eric Burdon was confronted by some Green Beret who's afraid we're going to beat him up as a hippie, who thanked him for it. And it remains as much the anthem as it ever was.
Yeah, and Emily, it had a lot to do with the tours in Vietnam. Unlike these last wars where you had multiple tours and men and women going back several times, that luckily didn't happen to us. And we had 13-month tours for the Marines and 12-month tours for the Army. And you lived for that day when you knew you were leaving. And that's so that notion of getting out of that place stayed with you. I mean, guys would count down from 300, 200, 100 days. I couldn't do that because I'd have gone crazy. But your DEROS date, the date you were going to leave Vietnam, was the most sacred date on the calendar. And that song kept helping you to anticipate that.
You talk in the book about other songs, too, where the lyrics meant something different to the people who wrote it and originally listened. But in Vietnam, those lyrics took on whole new meanings. What are some other examples that you can point to just of where the lyrics meant one thing here at home and then over there meant something different?
Well, one of them would be Nancy Sinatra's These Boots Are Made for Walking, which I never in a million years thought of as a Vietnam song. But then you start thinking about what your boots mean to you there. The Letter by the Box Tops.
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, get me a ticket for an aeroplane. We had a whole that changed the way you said airplane. But the notion of, sure, that's about a guy hearing from his girl jumping on a plane. But when you're in a place where you took a plane, you're away from your girlfriend, and letters were the most important thing in your life. I mean, mail call in Vietnam was another one of those sacred moments. So the song has got a whole nother base of substance to that and to you. So you can't not hear it and think of getting a letter from home.
even songs you point to, like My Girl, or just that you noticed a lot of soldiers pointing to songs about missing someone at home.
The biggest surprise to me when we started the book, we originally were going to do a Vietnam Vets Top 20 and organize it around that. And we were thinking of songs like For What It's Worth and Fortunate Son. And it became very clear very quickly that what mattered most was the girlfriends and the wives back home. My Girl, Gloria, any song with a woman's name in it.
Absolutely. And anything that kindled that aching and homesickness. Detroit City by Bobby Bear, which never was on my set list at all anywhere, although I heard it in jukeboxes in Vietnam. Green, Green Grass of Home.
Leaving on a Jet Plane by Peter, Paul, and Mary.
All of those. I mean, it can tear you up and bring a tear, but it was that reminder and that and it's like, you know, I miss somebody very, very dearly.
The 1960s, early 70s are a time of incredible social change, political turmoil, Black Panthers. You have music becoming kind of a way to point to one's own identity. We're going to look at some of those songs, songs that could trigger big arguments, when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. James Brown, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. I'm Emily Auerbach. I'm back with Doug Bradley and Craig Werner, and we are talking about their acclaimed book, We Gotta Get Out of This Place, the soundtrack of the Vietnam War. Of course, the military is a microcosm, and all kinds of class differences, racial differences, religious differences, musical taste differences can show up. Let's start with that song that we just heard, the James Brown.
I think you put it very well, Emily. I mean, when you think of what was happening in America at the time, just take Black power, Black civil rights, etc., the assassinations of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, on and on and on. You know, the draft boards chasing Muhammad Ali. You could not avoid that in the military. And it was always an interesting dynamic, because in many ways for young African-American men in this country, the military was a way to sort of get ahead. And, you know, it was a level playing field. Of course, it never was where race was concerned. But it was that way to get to move on. And so there was, a lot of Black participation in the military. I served with a lot of Black GIs. But when things started to hit and change, it got much more challenging, because you had an old, mainly white bureaucracy, hierarchy of officers and career soldiers. And you had these young Black GIs, many of whom were in kill or be killed situations. And they were starting to exert their rights as individuals. And boy, I mean, music was a place where some of that played out. But in the rear, when you had downtime, you're out in the field, doesn't matter what color you are, you got to take care of each other. But you're back in the rear, somebody plays a song in a jukebox you want to hear, and maybe throws a beer bottle or says something they shouldn't say, you could have some difficult times. So, boy, by the time I was there in 70 and 71, there were all Black units, segregated. They didn't want to have anything to do with the white guys, white soldiers, and the white soldiers didn't want to have anything to do with them. And it was a powder keg. I don't want to make it sound like, you know, we were in each other's throats all the time. But when you, like I said, when you're back in the rear, you're not in kill or be killed situations. You think you're all going home because Nixon's ending the war. It could get pretty dicey, especially around people exercising now their solidarity as a person of color.
And one of the songs that gives a real clear picture of how that worked out was Aretha Franklin's Chain of Fools.
Chain, chain, chain.
I wouldn't have necessarily thought of that as a Vietnam song.
Yeah. On the home front, that was a song that was about black women's assertion, about black assertion, about women's assertion. But when we started talking with particularly black GIs who were in Vietnam at the time of Martin Luther King's assassination, it took on a whole different set of meanings. People frequently talk about the Tet Offensive as being the turning point for the war in Vietnam, and that's not inaccurate. But the assassination of Dr. King was equally important because after that moment, there were a lot of black GIs who just said something to the effect of, if you can't protect my leader at home, I'm not going to fight your war over here. We talked to one GI who said that when he heard Dr. King had been assassinated, and the military tried to keep that knowledge secret because they were afraid of racial upheaval. He said when he heard that, the first thing he wanted to do was take revenge on the first white person he met. He said he knew better. He went out into the field with his tape deck and his copy of Aretha's Lady Soul album that was on. He said as he was listening to that and he got to that line about one of these mornings, the chain is going to break. For him, that meant the chain of command. And he said from that point on, he was not going to be the soldier that they had sent him there to be. And so that song became a manifestation of the racial tension. At the same time, we have other stories about Aretha where her music helped bring soldiers together. A black soldier from Mississippi talks about that as part of the bonding with one of his white colleagues. And Aretha, as I say, a little prayer. She talked about being for the GIs. And music was both source of tension and source of connection.
You talk in the book about how sometimes Vietnam was called the rock and roll war. And you have also playing out at home music as a way of one generation kind of really repudiating the generation before it. Lots of drugs. Lots of other things that are happening on both in Vietnam and at home surrounding the music. Can you talk about that a bit?
Well, and again, I think, you know, I think you started the segment off with this notion of dizzying change and everything that was happening at such rapid speed. And as you pointed out earlier, that the Army's a microcosm. And so if there's racial tension in America, boy, is there racial tension in the military. If there's discipline situation, a generational gap going on, I mean, it was my father's generation who were giving us the orders in Vietnam. And we were arguing with our fathers at home, so we're sure as heck maybe going to be disobeying orders in Vietnam. You talked about drugs. You just talked about, openness and awareness, exposure to different ideas and sometimes radical thinking. That was really part of what was going on. And it was happening in the military, and it was happening in Vietnam. I think that's part of what people forget is that, you know, when you look at the military that served, a third were drafted, guys like me. A third enlisted because they knew they were going to get drafted, because they wanted to try and get a better job, maybe not end up in Vietnam. And a third volunteered. So that's two-thirds of the military that really is maybe not anxious.
Not wanting to be there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So and you've got, like I said, career World War II and Korea, so generals and officers trying to run the show. It didn't work. I don't think it ever would have worked, especially in that war. But not with that generation.
And again, the music provides such a nice window on the multiple meanings, the way that songs meant one thing here, one thing there, one thing to different groups. And one of the songs really brings that into focus is Purple Haze by the Jimi Hendrix Experience.
Certainly sounds very different than the Green Beret song we started with.
Yeah, and back home, that was, for me, it was a drug song. It was about a form of LSD. But in Vietnam, it meant some very different things.
Well, they had M18 smoke grenades that they would have at landing zones. They called them LZs. So when you needed to be rescued, you wanted a helicopter to come in, you would pop a smoke grenade, and one of the colors was purple. So we have many guys, of course, you know, maybe doing drugs, maybe big Hendrix fans. There were a lot of them in Vietnam. But the reminiscence for them is the purple haze is seeing that purple smoke at the landing zone, knowing a helicopter is going to come in and rescue them. And I think Hendrix got that in some ways, too. Maybe not. You know, maybe subliminally, but he was a soldier. He was a screaming eagle. He jumped out of airplanes. He was a bad soldier. They kicked him out of the army. But so sonically in Vietnam, especially by the time I got there, when you start to look at, we were talking a minute ago about the change and everything that was happening with music and with society, Hendrix sort of captured that in his sound. And he really replicated the soundscape of Vietnam, helicopters and machine guns and just commotion and freneticism and firefights. You can hear it in Hendrix.
I hear the anger.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Rage. And the version of the Star Spangled Banner he played at Woodstock just breaks up into pure chaos with a little bit of military songs. And it sounds like the chaos that the war was.
You talk about at one point about the horrible job of going down into the tunnels and relating that to this song.
Yeah. One of the things about Vietnam is that there was no one Vietnam experience. It depended upon when you were there, where you were, and what you did. And one of the stories that we got in the book involved a guy who was a tunnel rat. And tunnel rats were worst job ever. When units discovered a tunnel, and the VC, North Vietnamese, spent a lot of time underground, when you discovered a tunnel, somebody had to go back in and check it out. And it could be booby-trapped. All you had was a flashlight and a 45, and just a horrible job. One guy who was a tunnel rat, what he would do before he went into the tunnel was he'd take a little battery-driven fan, a Mighty Mite fan, and pop a smoke grenade and blow the smoke in so he could see where it was coming out, where it went. And he would blast purple haze to let him know he was coming because nobody wanted to meet anybody down there. Never dreamt of that back home.
My understanding is you interviewed a lot more veterans than even can fit into this book.
Yeah. Yes, yes. And some still, even with the cue of the music and as a, you know, maybe an easier way in, still couldn't talk. Again, what we're up against. But, the stories were so rich. The conversations were so powerful. As Craig said, I think that's why we felt obliged as we got close to figuring we were finished, that we needed the step. We needed to remove ourselves as much as we could, hence the solos and the way we try to position things so that those voices ring true and we're just there sort of as a chorus.
Yeah. And you probably have now a lot of veterans coming forward who have read the book who now want to add their voices in.
Absolutely. Every time we do a public event, the conversations are just amazing. Afterwards, when we were in Memphis, we had a conversation between black vets and white vets that probably the most honest conversation about race in the military and maybe about race anywhere that I've ever heard, just opened it up.
Where did country music fit in Vietnam?
It was big. That country music, rock and roll, and soul music were the three primary types of music. Everything played there in some ways.
Yes.
But there were an awful lot of Southern vets, an awful lot of vets from small towns in the Midwest for whom country music was the first music. So we got a lot of stories about George Jones, Porter Wagoner, Bobby Bear's Detroit City, I Want to Go Home. It's about a Southern migrant working in a car factory in Detroit, but it became a song about Vietnam, just the way that we got to get out of this place did.
And that's one of the interesting things is that we have these wonderful stories from guys that we have – there's a lot of Wisconsin vets in there because we're here and they sort of, you know, crowded around us, although we did get out and I think cover the whole country and territory. But guys from small towns in Wisconsin who had no other musical experience to have their experience in Vietnam and the guys they served with open things up. I was opened up to country music because of Vietnam, because I was a guy from Philadelphia and I would listen to R&B and a little bit of the British sound. So it worked in a variety of different ways. And it's just kind of fun to have those moments where somebody says he never knew there was a group like the Mamas and the Papas or Cream or the Doors until he was in Vietnam.
Were there songs that couldn't be played on the radio in Vietnam because they would have been seen as too incendiary?
Yes. It's what's interesting is how the story of radio censorship sort of waxes and wanes depending on, again, when you were there and what was going on at the time. We have some wonderful, wonderful conversations with radio DJs from Vietnam, some on the normal bandwidth and some on pirate stations, which was another great phenomenon in Vietnam. And they did not want a song like Ruby Don't Take Your Love to Town, which is about a guy shooting his girlfriend because he's a paralyzed vet. It's not based in Vietnam, but just that message. You're not going to play that. There were times when we got to get out of this place, according to some of the DJs we talked to, was not allowed to be played. It wasn't available on the set list. Eve of Destruction. They will not play that song even today. We hear from people. That was 1965. Again, going back early, talk about a parallel with the Ballad of the Green Berets. But that song by Barry McGuire, which only has one reference to the Eastern world, it is exploding. That's the Vietnam reference. But just he's angry. The world is not going right. The generation has loused everything up, and we're going to hell in a handbasket. They would never play that on a military radio station.
We're going to look at some more songs and comments about music of the Vietnam War when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. Sound of Marvin Gaye. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Doug Bradley and Craig Werner, co-authors of We Gotta Get Out of This Place, the soundtrack of the Vietnam War. Tell us about that Marvin Gaye song.
Well, I think that spotlights one of the most important parts of the whole story, which is the role that music played in healing vets once they came back to the world. And we've got beautiful story from a vet named Art Flowers in Memphis, who says it was he came back and he was just wasting his life. He was getting stoned, getting drunk, doing nothing. And he heard Marvin's album and it snapped him back and said that I've got to do my part in this struggle as a warrior for my people's rights and the rights of all humanity. And Marvin pretty much knew what he was doing when he made that album.
Well, and Art and Marvin were connected on that because that's exactly what Marvin was trying to accomplish with the music. His brother Frankie was less fortunate and less famous and ended up in Vietnam in 1967 and 1968. Wrote letters home to Marvin and his mom and dad, and as we all did, to try and keep our sanity. What he didn't know was that Marvin was reading them and was very concerned about what was going on. Wasn't just out there being a big record star. And when he arrived back in the States, they spent about the first two nights Frankie was home just talking. Marvin doing what a lot of vets needed to have happen, which is what Frankie got, which was, I'm here to listen to you. I'm not going to judge. I'm not going to ask questions. I'm going to listen. And they talked for, you know, almost 2 days. And when he got done, Marvin said, I didn't know what I needed to do about this until now. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to make music. And he made one of the greatest albums of all time with this lead song that is one continuous flow of Frankie Gaye and a Vietnam veteran's odyssey back to America. And maybe never really getting back. And the last note of the last song, Inner City Blues, makes me want to holler, which is as strong and tough and powerful and defiant a message as you'll get, is the first note of what's going on. So it loops and goes around. So guys like Frankie Gay, no longer here, but guys like Frankie Gay are still trying to close that loop to get home. And I think Marvin brilliantly, brilliantly knew that.
And did Marvin Gaye intend it to be a healing process?
Yeah, he very much did. And he actually had to fight with Berry Gordy and Motown to have the album released. Berry Gordy didn't think it had any hits on it. He said, Marvin, you know, people want to hear your love songs. I want to hear your Ain't No Mountain High Enough. And Marvin basically said, I'm going to release this. And until you release this, I'm not making any more of those hit records for you. And Berry Gordy said, okay, I'll release it, Marvin, but one of us is going to learn something. And then to his credit, Berry Gordy said, I learned something from that. But it's one of many songs that speaks to the way that music helps in the healing of veterans. We have people talking about the White Album. We have people talking about the role the jazz played in helping them learn to think outside the boxes they were being put into. And one of the most beautiful pieces in the book, we actually end the book with it, is a solo that was a radio piece done by a vet from New York named Jay Maloney. And he set his meditation on Memorial Day a few years ago. He'd been back for decades before he could tell the story. And he created this sound piece to the accompaniment of a song called Southbound to Marion by a group called The Rachels, which talks about his experience in Vietnam.
There's no such thing as one Vietnam. The Vietnam I lived through was mostly at a MASH-type hospital located at Chu Lai, about 60 miles south of Da Nang. I arrived there in the late summer of 1968. I was 20 years old, and I had more of a sense of adventure than trepidation when I arrived. I left a year later at 21, embittered and old. Sandwiched between that coming and going were slices of brutality that I fear to this day will remain the eternal standard against which I will compare all other moments of my life. The year's worth of carnage that I had seen and smelled and touched had finally knocked me down sometime in late spring of 1969. The horrors of that year had finally come into a grisly focus for me. There was that Vietnamese woman who had been scalped from her eyebrows to the back of her neck by the North Vietnamese Army while her family and neighbors were forced to watch. There was the helicopter crewman whose hands and arms had been charred down to the very bone. There were the two Vietnamese prisoners who had been rescued from a Viet Cong tunnel, so starved that they had become living skeletons, unable to move anything but their hollow madman eyes. There was the teenage GI whose entire jaw had been shot right off of his face and who was going to live out the rest of his life as a freak in some VA hospital. In the endless stream of wrecked bodies that we had the clinical conceit to call as casualties, it was all just a bit too much. And there was more to come. The final blow for me landed a few weeks later. It was on a Sunday. It was June 8th at 7 a.m. Shortly after sunrise on that perfectly cloudless day, my friend, Sharon, a nurse who had been in country only since April, was killed in one of the rocket attacks that our hospital was regularly treated to. Three artillery rockets hit us that morning, one of which struck her ward, the Vietnamese ward, directly and dead center. She was graced with a painless death, delivered by a single, spoon-sized fragment that clipped her aorta. Ward 4 was awash with smoke and screams that morning, but my strongest image from that day is the ocean of bright red, rust-scented and still warm blood that seconds earlier had filled her small body. Sharon was a sweet, gentle-souled person, and this one death, this one among the vast crowd, this one was so particularly purposeless, so particularly cruel, that my light went out that morning. I was as empty as she was. Extinguished and spent, I was lingering at the doorway of oblivion, evacuated of any and all feeling. The post-war years bled from one into another. It took a while, but I figured out some important things along that pathway. I figured out that I hadn't cheated death at all in Vietnam. None of us cheat death. Ask any veteran and they will tell you one thing, this one truth. Death in war is a random thing, and therein lays the real terror of it. It is also the root stem of survivor's guilt. Over the softening years, I have seen how anger and grief fuse with the evils of war. I've seen how bitterness and anger can become one's closest companions, and I have seen how those things will stick around only because we keep inviting them to stay. I saw how letting go of anger and grief and guilt is an act of the will, not a function of passing time. And I know until my time does come, as it must and as it will, I am simply blessed to be alive on this fine day, on this fine earth, a blessing that was laid down hard by 58,000 of our fellow countrymen. I have seen that we can short-circuit the remorse of surviving our wars by purposefully sharing certain moments of our lives with the memory and spirit of those people we've lost. As if they were still among us, I dial up each of my friends from time to time. This need to remember them is a good thing, and it doesn't happen on just Memorial Day. It usually comes upon me when I least expect it. But whenever it comes, I surrender right then and right there, and I crank up my senses for just one of them at a time. I will share certain moments or do certain things for them and for me together, and in those brief moments, life is bigger and louder and so full of flavor. I've taken extra long hot showers for them. I've gone to bed early for them. I've had hot dogs at hockey games and an unbroken string of Christmas mornings with my beloved wife and my children just for them. But I know I'll never stop grieving for my friends and my comrades, because they've earned to be grieved over forever. But the grief waves are now spaced further apart, and I thank God that the only fears that my children ever knew were the shadows that were in their bedrooms at night. The inner eye has looked hard at the anger that I held in my heart. It has seen how that anger has become the ghost of much more than Vietnam, this thing that would haunt my soul until it destroyed me, unless I said to stop it. I've chosen to forgive, to let that anger go, to leave it behind evil and abandoned. Its presence in my heart violated the right memory of my comrades and my friends, and they deserve better.
Powerful elegy.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say anything after that. And in the book, we don't. That really is, in many ways, a last word on that. They deserve better. Some we ought to learn.
And if you had one thing that you would want readers of your book, We Gotta Get Out of This Place, to take away from it, to, you know, if you write a book, sometimes you hope people are changed in some way. There's a take-home message. What would that be?
For me, it's listen to the veterans of Vietnam, of Iraq, of Afghanistan, and know that it's not about trying to change it. It's not doing anything except trying to let them speak.
And I think try to come to some sense of understanding of what we ask people to do in our name and why we keep doing it, because war is about death and killing. And I don't, at times I just don't understand why we haven't learned that lesson, because it breaks the people that have to do that in our name, and then we turn our backs on them.
My guests have been Craig Werner and Doug Bradley. Their book is We Gotta Get Out of This Place, The Soundtrack of the Vietnam War. Thank you both for being my guests, and thank you for this long labor of love together to bring out the voices of veterans and to use the music really as a gateway into the deeper experiences that in many ways had not been brought forth before. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.